happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. You can also listen to today's program, or any program, over the telephone by calling 619-550-0869. You can watch this by going to Ustream and then searching for Gary Null. Today, we're going to explore in our environmental segment the new crisis at Fukushima and new information that has not been covered in any of the American media yet. This is an exclusive, Tokyo radiation hotspots. We will be playing a clip that you can watch as well as listen to with Arne Gunderson, who has just returned from Japan and is very concerned. And I've been telling you for some time that the soil is showing radioactive hotspots. I'll have two newsmakers on, Professor Carl Grossman, professor of journalism at State University of New York, and a leading investigative journalist for over 45 years on environmental issues, and Joe Mangano, executive director of the Radiation and Public Health Project, to talk about the impact of radiation. From our health and nutrition segment today, the latest on seaweeds, why we have to be letting our legislators know that don't protect Monsanto. They're back at it again. Also, a lot of pediatricians are giving children CAT scans. They shouldn't. I'll explain why. New studies on getting your brain healthier with curcumin and unexpected benefits of olive leaf extract. That and more on getting us healthier. Then commentary on the origins of our police state from Chris Hedges from Truthdig, and breaking news on a covert human papillomavirus vaccine trial, the government report that Bill Gates Foundation, Merck, and GlaxoSmithKline targeting illiterate adolescents without consent in India, Uganda, and Peru to test their vaccines. We'll give you that. If time permits, I intend today to give you an in-depth analysis of what has not been anywhere, not even in the alternative media, not even in the liberal media, on the real reasons that we're interested in Syria. And it doesn't really have anything to do with the sarin gas. Yes, there was sarin gas. That's been proven by the UN. It has not been proven who actually did it. And we do know that the rebels are also using gas and have it. But it has to do with something more insidious. From the Colbert Report, we'll have an in-depth analysis. As you see, we have a packed program. Let's begin. If you've ever been to the Orient, virtually all the countries use seaweed. It's a mainstay of their diet. They have hundreds of different seaweeds and prepared either cold or hot or fermented. But if you talk with the average person, why do you use seaweeds? Especially among the men, it'll come up that it empowers them with their libido. Well, that may actually be correct on a scientific level, because there's new information about how seaweed and sexual health goes hand in hand. Now, we know that seaweed, according to Lisa Lawless, PhD, talks about how it increases our overall health. I agree with that. But people often overlook the wonderful sexual health benefit it offers. In both men and women, seaweed has been linked to an increase in libido and energy levels. And all four classes of seaweeds, now they're blue, they're green, they're red, and they're brown, they've all been shown to have aphrodisiac properties due to the mineral manganese that they contain. In addition, their B12 content provides assistance in hormone production. In fact, they're so influential in this area that a study using seaweed bladder wrack, B-L-A-D-D-E-R, bladder wrack, W-A-R-C-K, has shown evidence that it lengthens the whole ability to be able to stay younger longer. In fact, in the Orient, the women there use it to help postpone or minimize the symptoms of menopause. And this is because seaweed exerts anti-estrogenic impacts on premenopausal women. Now, men also benefit from seaweeds. They're high in producing healthy sperm. This is accomplished by the ability of the nutrients to limit free radicals and regulate overall sexual gland function. And the health benefits of seaweeds are impressive and contribute to your overall sense of well-being. They're good for your thyroid gland. They're low in calories, low in fat. It's an excellent food. And I'm surprised that no one's really started drying them as they have kale, because for those of you who would like to do your own home-based business, I would suggest you take a wide variety of seaweeds, dry them. You can use a little home dryer that costs about $150. Season them and then package them and sell them. It's a good market for that. Seaweeds help keep your blood pressure down because they're rich in potassium. They can help control your cholesterol because they're rich in taurine. They also help combat depression and fatigue because they're high in B1 and B12, which impacts cognitive functioning. So, one more reason to have sea vegetables in our daily diet. Many of you supported the efforts to stop our Congress from granting Monsanto the ability to release its seeds into the environment, even if there were no long-term studies showing their safety. It was called the Monsanto Protection Act, and it protected the biotech juggernaut from any legal action, even when it comes to federal courts. Well, once again, that's been resurrected. In fact, according to Anthony Guicciardi, this time even more corrupt politicians are trying to go ahead and extend the act in order to shield Monsanto from courts. Now, he first reported on the original March Monsanto Protection Act before it hit the mainstream media, and thankfully, we were successful in pushing it as a major talking point internationally. Unfortunately, the act was passed through being slipped in as a rider on an emergency Senate spending bill. Senators were forced to pass the bill with Monsanto Protection Act included, granting Monsanto the immunity that they were seeking. Now we are seeing the exact same scenario. Monsanto has once again managed to weasel its way into legislation by using politicians who have utterly failed to represent the public in any capacity to push through a renewal of the immunity. According to the Huffington Post, quote, House Republicans will include an extension of the so-called Monsanto Protection Act in the spending bill designed to avert a government shutdown, according to the text of the legislation released Wednesday by House Appropriations Committee Hal Rogers, Republican of Kentucky. The Monsanto measure was originally enacted into law in March by being slipped into a previous spending resolution, which is now set to expire, end quote. It is now up to us to blast this out and block Monsanto from receiving immunity once more from the courts. After all, the absolute last thing we need is a disease machine biotechnology company like Monsanto to have more authority than even a federal court. So contact your legislators today, please, and say no to Monsanto's Protection Act. I did an expose, wrote an article, did a full-hour broadcast about 12 years ago on the subject of CAT scans. Here's the deal. Once someone invents a technology, it's absolutely certain that it's going to be used, irrespective of its need or its cost. It gets into the bureaucracy and the technocrats begin to use it. That was the case of CAT scans, which I'm opposed to. This is from the University of California, Davis. And this is the latest published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Pediatrics. Quote, according to a study of 7 healthcare systems, the use of computed tomography, CAT scans, of the head, abdomen, pelvis, chest, and spine in children younger than 14 more than doubled from 1996 to 2005, and this associated radiation is projected to potentially increase the risk of radiation-induced cancer in these children in the future, according to the newest study. The use of CAT scan in pediatrics has increased over the last 2 decades. The ionizing radiation doses delivered by the tests are higher than conventional radiography and are in ranges that have been linked to an increased risk of cancer. Children are more sensitive to radiation-induced carcinogenesis and have many years of life left for cancer developed, the authors write in the study. Quote, the increased use of CAT scans in pediatrics combined with a wide variability in radiation doses has resulted in many children receiving a high-dose examination. And that's unfortunate. So my suggestion is this. Whenever you've been told that your child needs a CAT scan, immediately seek another qualified opinion, hopefully from a holistic physician that will be able to do a less invasive examination. There's new information on curcumin, published in Experimental Gerontology. It says that the curcumin was able to help in the aging process, especially help your arteries and improve your cognition. Now, this was not at high doses. It was 14 grams, which is, that would be, let's see, the equivalent of 14 grams a day per curcumin. That would be about 14,000 milligrams. So, by the way, curcumin is not well absorbed, so that's why you generally have to use higher amounts, generally in doses 8 to 12 grams. But they had tremendous results. There were 2 studies, and the second study was published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Biogerontology, and it was done at the university in Turkey, and they wanted to see what it does to the brain. And in this lab study, it improved cognition. So here's the takeaway message. There are a lot of nutrients that we could be and should be taking, but then there's super nutrients. Those are absolutely unique, like garlic and aloe vera and vitamin C and quercetin. Those are simply at the top of a list. Curcumin is certainly one of them. There are over 1,000 studies in the literature showing that it can extend the health of your cardiovascular system. It can reduce your likelihood of cancer. It can help repair damage to DNA damaged cells. It can help neutralize a lot of free radicals. It's just good at everything that it's used for. Generally, when a person is sick with a cold or flu, or they feel the beginning signs, they start taking, if they're wise, they take olive leaf extract. There's so much science on this. There's a new report from Julian Everson that talks about this unique molecule that they have found in olive oil that extends our life. And it is known as oleuropein, and it's a polyphenol, and it can help lower your bad cholesterol. It can lower your blood pressure. It can prevent cancer. It protects your cells from oxidative damage. It helps guard against cognitive decline. And it has a distinctive, tangy, pungent, almost bitter flavor found in high-quality virgin olive oils. By the way, most people are not aware that the better the olive oil, the stronger its taste. When I first had my taste of extra virgin, first-pressed olive oil, it was in Italy. And it was in the wine country. We were, my brother, Howard, and friends were on a trip. I was studying the health benefits of living in the city versus in the country in Italy. And we were going to Rome and Venice. And the other major metropolitan areas. We went into this small restaurant, and there was some oil, and I went to put this oil on the salad, and I stopped because it was so dark. And I said, is this olive oil? She said, yes, of course, olive oil. So I tasted some, and it really had a strong taste to it. For me, it was not tasty. And then this woman sat down, this older woman, and she explained that this came from the olive trees that her family has owned for hundreds of years, and that she does this little tiny restaurant, beautiful setting. In fact, after the meal, I went across the road, and there was this huge field. I'm going to guess it was 400 or 500 acres, and it was wheat, and it was August, so you could hear the clapping of the wheat against each other, and it had this wonderful sound. I hadn't heard that since I was out in wheat country in the Midwest in the summer, and then you hear it because it's dry, so it clacks, and there was a breeze off the Mediterranean. It was perfection. And I was just sitting under a tree for an hour or so, just listening to this and feeling it and thinking, I'm in a wonderful place. This is a remarkable moment in the middle of the Tang countryside. And then I've just thought, 500 to 1,000 years ago, someone else had been probably sitting under this tree and smelling the ocean, feeling the breeze. It just doesn't get better than this. And then when I spoke about all the olives, she said, oh, there are hundreds of different olives, but what you get in America is already filtered. You don't have a taste for really the original version. The man says, yes, and you don't drink wine the way that we who ferment it ourselves do, because we don't filter out all the particulate matter in there. And indeed, they are correct. So that was my first experience. Well, now we know that that is really what is the healing molecule, the extra virgin, high-quality olive oil. And it's also responsible for most of olive oil's antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, and disease-fighting characteristics. In fact, that one nutrient, that one single polyphenol is what's given for cancer. In fact, in Italy, they give it for tumors in dogs. And the tumors completely regressed and disappeared in 9 to 12 days in one study. Now, the olive tree, which is the olea tree over there, O-L-E-A, Europea, E-U-R-O-P-A-E-A, it produces this polyphenol abundantly in its leaves, as well as in the olive fruit. And I grew olive trees. It takes years before they finally give you a fruit. And then each year it gives you more and more fruit. And if you have bees, it really gives you fruit. Well, they have a special processing technique now that allows for the extraction of a stable, standardized form of this. And that means that consumers can have access to one of the most beneficial components of olive oil without the necessity of consuming a lot of olive oil. It's the olive leaf extract and this polyphenol. And that's what lowers your blood pressure, lowers your cholesterol, is anti-inflammatory, fights our atherosclerosis, diabetes, cancer, neurodegenerative disease, and even fibromyalgia. In fact, there were animal studies demonstrating that olive leaf extract leads to significant drops in elevated blood pressure. And remarkably, these effects are evident when supplementation occurs either before or after the process of hypertension gets high. So that's all good. So now you know that you can help your arteries, you can help your heart, you can help your blood pressure with olive leaf extract. And it's all part of the Mediterranean diet. It also has a strong impact upon cancer. In fact, the Mediterranean diet is renowned for its ability to reduce the risk of cancer. And because it helps protect DNA damage from reactive oxygen species, which is the first step in developing malignant cells to begin with. So, and it's neuroprotective. Now, for the women out there who've not been using vitamin D, you should. Why? Because it protects you. According to the latest study in the peer-reviewed American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, breast cancer is 600% higher in women with low vitamin D. So we know vitamin D deficiency is a major cause of breast cancer among women. And so I would suggest between 1 to 5,000 units of vitamin D a day. That's the latest in health and nutrition. I'm Gary Knoll. Now we're going to go in a moment to our two guests who will be standing by to bring us up to date on Fukushima. And but before then, I want to play you Arne Gundersen, who is a leading scientist on the subject of radiation and the dangers of our current nuclear power system. And this is only about 2.5 minutes long, where he's attending a Nuclear Regulatory Commission symposium. But he has just returned from Japan, and he took some samples. So listen to this. I think you'll find it of interest.
Nuclear Regulatory Commission's chairman, Gregory Yasko, saying that the NRC doesn't take into account mass evacuations and people not getting back on their land for centuries when it does a cost-benefit analysis as to whether or not a nuclear plant should be licensed. I'm Arne Gundersen from Fairwinds, and today I'm at the Regulatory Information Conference put on by the NRC in Washington, D.C. So today, I'm in Washington, D.C. A couple weeks ago, though, I was in Tokyo. And when I was in Tokyo, I took some samples. Now, I didn't look for the highest radiation spot. I just went around with five plastic bags. And when I found an area, I just scooped up some dirt and put it in the bag. One of those samples was from a crack in the sidewalk. Another one of those samples was from a children's playground that had been previously decontaminated. Another sample had come from some moss on the side of the road. Another sample came from a the roof of an office building that I was at. And the last sample was right across the street from the main judicial center in downtown Tokyo. Well, I brought those samples back, declared them through customs, and sent them to the lab. And the lab determined that all of them would be qualified as radioactive waste here in the United States and would have to be shipped to Texas to be disposed of. Now think about the ramifications for the nation's capital, whether it's Tokyo or the United States. How would you like it if you went to pick your flowers and were kneeling in radioactive waste? That's what's happening in Tokyo now. And I think that's the point that Chairman Yasko was trying to make. When the Nuclear Regulatory Commission does its cost-benefit analyses now, it doesn't take into account the cost to society if you have to evacuate for generations or if you have to move 100,000 people, perhaps forever. There's 100 miles between us and about a dozen nuclear power plants here in Washington, D.C. Fukushima was almost 200 miles away from Tokyo. And yet Tokyo soil, in some places, the ones I just happened to find, would qualify as radioactive waste here in the States. How would we feel if our nation's capital were contaminated to that degree? So I agree with Chairman Yasko. New nukes and old nukes that are being relicensed should include as a cost in their analysis what we've learned to be happening in Tokyo and in Japan. Thank you very much, and I'll keep you informed.
Now, keep in mind that that was just random samplings. What that means is that all of those samples, every single random sample, was contaminated. In the United States, if that same test were done and we had the same level of radiation, people would not be able to be in that. It would be condemned. So what I'm saying is this, that right now the Japanese government is terrified to do an exhaustive study of the water, the aquifer system, the current drinking water and all soil samples in farming areas, residential, suburban, and urban areas, because I believe if they did, they would find that the acceptable level of radiation, which would be about zero, their entire population would be exposed, and those in Tokyo would be exposed at such a level that it would promote future cancers or adverse effects. Now, they don't want to panic people. They don't want a mass exodus because the bubble they've been living in, the real estate bubble, would collapse. Their economy would collapse. After all, if people were having to move en masse out of the largest city in the world, Tokyo, with 40 million people, what would that mean for all the factories manufacturing parts that would also be contaminated? Nobody would be buying their computers, their cars, and other things. So they're simply not looking and not testing where they should be, and they're not honest when they do. Joining me on the phone right now is Joe Mangano, the Executive Director of the Radiation and Public Health Project. Nice to have you with us today, Joe.
Oh, good to be here, Gary.
Joe, yesterday Fukushima dodged a bullet. It was hit by a typhoon, as was all Japan, and there were 400,000 people that had to be evacuated out of one area of Japan alone because of the incredible amount of flooding. It was getting 3 inches of water per hour, and we were concerned of what this might do to building number 4 and the precarious position of the 250 tons of spent fuel rods that exist there, and yet the American media virtually ignored this story of what possibly could have been the worst environmental disaster in world history. Bring us up to date on Fukushima, and do you believe that the Japanese government and their environmental efforts have been honest with the public as far as the amount of exposure they've had up to this point and what this means to future generations and the current living people of developing future cancers because they've been allowed to stay in excessively high levels of radiation?
Well, first of all, Gary, I'm pleased that you are covering this topic, not just today, but you've covered it numerous times. Unfortunately, the mainstream media covers what they consider new, something that's new. And they did that back in March 2011 when the meltdown occurred. But soon after, they sort of lost interest. It's the Fukushima situation has been news every single day for the last 2.5 years because it is still not controlled. Even Chernobyl, which was a dreadful meltdown that harmed millions and millions of people, was brought under control within a matter of weeks. The Soviets dumped a combination of salt and sand and dirt on the pile, and then put a sarcophagus over it. So even though it's still red hot, it's controlled. Fukushima is not controlled. There is radioactivity in huge amounts of this very poisonous material constantly being emitted into the air, into the ground, into the groundwater, into the Pacific every single day. So this is a story that really must be followed. The first question you asked was about the Japanese government and their honesty and forthrightness with giving information on how bad the contamination is and what the health effects are. Very simple answer. They're not. We get some information that kind of dribbles out from Japan about what the levels of emissions are over time. Actually, a couple of weeks ago, for once, the news was made when for unknown reasons, the amount of emissions just within a week went up like 20 times what they had been a week before, which was bad enough. And that actually made newspapers and the ABC and CBS nightly news and so forth for just night. The situation is quite bad, not just in the Fukushima area, but all of Japan and in other countries, because as you well know, there is no magical lead wall that stops these poisons once they get into the environment. And that, I think, a good example is that excellent tape you just played by Arne Gunderson during his trip to Tokyo. It's 100 plus, I think, 120 miles from Fukushima, but sure enough, it's high levels. Not as high as at the plant, but certainly much higher levels and unsafe levels were documented there, not by the Japanese government, but by him. That's the situation in as far as contamination goes. The second part of the question, of course, is logical, and that is health. You know, when you have this all these poisons out, what's happened to people's health? There is actually a study of children in the Fukushima area that's ongoing by the Fukushima Medical University. Their job is to examine thyroid glands of nearly 200,000 children that live near Fukushima, children under 18 years old. The thyroid, even though radiation harms the entire body, the thyroid, which is, you know, is sort of a butterfly-like gland wrapped around the throat, is especially at risk because of the radioactive iodine. That's part of the deadly cocktail in radioactive emissions. So far, they have come out with two findings. One, 43.6% of the children have been detected with some sort of a cyst or a nodule, a growth on their thyroid gland. Not quite cancer yet, but these are precancerous growths. That's a staggeringly high number. Number two, they have documented, I believe the latest number is up to 18 cases of thyroid cancer with another 25 suspected in the last 2 years. It doesn't sound like much, but under normal conditions, there should have been less than one child, you know, between zero and one child in that population with thyroid cancer. So we're talking about 20 to 30 times above expected. And this is just the beginning. You know, the as with Chernobyl, harm just doesn't occur in the first, you know, a few months or a year or two. It goes on for decades and decades, and the toll rises steadily, unfortunately. And I think,
well, Joe, here is the idea. The wind blows about an average of 10 to 12 miles per hour, and that means within 10 hours to 12 hours, all of Tokyo is going to be getting air that is polluted with particulate matter from the ice dopes from the radiation. And then that builds up and that accumulates because it doesn't biodegrade down. So what you're having is you're having an entire country that is now polluted with Tokyo, the largest concentration of people in the world, that is getting enormous amount of pollution. So we're looking at tens of millions of adverse health effects, millions of potential future cancer cases, and the government is doing nothing about it. The American media is doing nothing. No one's paying attention, and there's no solutions. So the longer people live in Japan, the worse it's going to be until either another earthquake collapses the building, a storm collapses it, or structural instability collapses it, and then you have something that's equivalent to 12,000 Hiroshima bombs or about 12 times worse than Chernobyl, and then maybe we'll pay attention to it. I just think it's a disgrace. I think we should be marshaling all the scientific sources in the world to deal with this problem. This is our number one problem, and we're not dealing with it.
I couldn't agree more with you, Gary. And really, 2.5 years later, there is still no solution to containing this radioactivity. They're talking about building an ice wall, they call it, and putting it underneath the ground. It's an untested technology. It could shift with the next earthquake. It's going to take a couple of years to build. I mean, again, 2.5 years later, they're still kind of scratching their heads saying, what do we do as these poisons continue to enter our environment?
I just believe that we're going to end up seeing probably between 10 and 20 million Japanese over the next 20 years with cancers that could have been prevented had anyone cared enough to be honest and diligent. Joe, thank you for bringing us up to date. And your website, Joe, for people who'd like more information?
Oh, thanks, Gary. Please go to www.radiation.org. We're the only U.S. group that does peer-reviewed journal articles on radiation from nuclear reactors and their health hazards.
Joe Mangano, M-A-N-G-A-N-O, and he also is the author of a book, Low Level Radiation and Immune System Disorders, An Atomic Era Legacy, website radiation.org. Thank you, Joe.
Thanks, Gary.
I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to go immediately into a report. I don't think we'll have time to give it all to you. This is from the Corbett Report, and it deals with the real reasons that Syria is the issue and flashpoint that it is, and listen to the insights that are going to be shared with you.
We're going to break down the different pieces of this puzzle, starting with a clip that I think will probably be familiar to most of the audience by now. It's a clip of General Wesley Clark, the retired four-star U.S. general who was also the supreme allied commander of NATO back in 1999 during the Kosovo war crimes that NATO committed at that time, who back in 2007 made waves by talking about a plan that he overheard in the bowels of the Pentagon in the days after 9/11, about a plan to invade 7 countries in 5 years, and some very familiar countries appeared on that list, including Iraq, including Libya, and including Syria. So this speech has made the rounds quite a bit in the last few years and tends to come up every time there seems to be new talk about invading one of these countries that are on this list. So let's take a short listen to this clip where General Wesley Clark talks about what he overheard at the Pentagon.
I went downstairs. I was leaving the Pentagon, and an officer from the Joint Staff called me into his office and said, I want you to know, he said, sir, we're going to attack Iraq. And I said, why? He said, we don't know. He said, I said, well, did they tie Saddam to 9/11? He said, no. And then I came back to the Pentagon about 6 weeks later. I saw the same officer. I said, why haven't we attacked Iraq? We still going to attack Iraq? He said, oh, sir. He says, it's worse than that. He said, he pulled up a piece of paper off his desk. He said, I just got this memo from the Secretary of Defense's office. It says we're going to attack and destroy the governments in 7 countries in 5 years. We're going to start with Iraq, and then we're going to move to Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Iran. I said, 7 countries in 5 years. I said, is that a classified memo? He said, yes, sir. I said, well, don't show it to me. He was about to show it to me. He said, because I want to talk about it. The purpose of the military is to start wars and change governments. It's not to sort of deter conflict. This country was taken over by a group of people with a policy coup. Wolfowitz and Cheney and Rumsfeld, and you could name a half dozen other collaborators from the Project for a New American Century. They wanted us to destabilize the Middle East, turn it upside down, make it under our control.
Now, I think a little too much has been made of this speech in alternative media circles of late, at least this go around in the lead up to the impending strike on Syria, because there are a number of things that we should be skeptical about regarding this testimony from Clark. Not only the fact that he is a retired four-star U.S. general and the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, so I think we should take everything he says with a grain of salt, but also, even if he is reporting accurately what he overheard about a classified memo that he never even saw, we should keep in mind that this was coming out of the Rumsfeld Pentagon in the wake of 9/11, so this is something that he overheard 12 years ago, and this was supposedly a 5-year plan that was meant to kick off with the invasion of Iraq. The invasion of Iraq did take place in 2003, which would mean that this 5-year plan would have been instituted and completed by 2008, which, of course, it was not. Also, It does seem that he was giving a chronological order to the invasions that were supposed to take place under this plan, starting with Iraq, then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off with Iran, and assuming that that's the order that, this was all supposed to take place in under this classified memo, well, that hasn't taken place either. So we should be skeptical about this and not make too much about this supposed five-year plan that, again, we have no documentation of, and we're just taking General Clark's word for it. But I think the more important part of this is the underlying policy that seemed to be at play here, and what was really part of the strategy for reshaping the Middle East that very much was part of the agenda of the Bush-era Pentagon under Rumsfeld, and of course directed by the policy planners and Iraq war policy planners of the Project for a New American Century. And when we look at the people who were in the bowels of the Pentagon really planning all of this, we're looking, of course, at people like Paul Wolfowitz and Douglas Faith and Richard Perle and others who obviously and documentably have extensive ties to Israel, with, in fact, people like Wolfowitz and Faith being actually investigated for their parts in spying for Israel in the past. So we don't have to go out on too much of a limb to say that there was a very concerted Zionist agenda behind the Project for a New American Century and its quest to reshape the Middle East. And Israel's designs on Iraq have been well known and well understood for a long time, but I think we have to see all of these invasions and overthrows and all of the destabilization in the Middle East in recent years as part of a grander Zionist project for reshaping the Middle East that we can say not only predates that five-year plan that General Wesley Clark talks about, but predates it by decades, at the very least, documentably and on the record. So let's take a look at part of that record, and we're going to take a look at an important document that you can find out more about at an article that was posted on globalresearch.ca in March of this year called Greater Israel, the Zionist Plan for the Middle East. And this talks about the Oded Yunon Plan, which was something that was developed in a document that was published in 1982 in the journal called Directions, that's published by the Department of Information for the World Zionist Organization. And this document was translated into English by the Association of Arab American University Graduates. So I will put the English translation in the links for the show notes for today's episode, so you can go and read this document for yourself directly. I think it's a very eye-opening document going back again, well, actually 3 decades now, to Israel's bigger foreign policy and its plans for basically breaking and carving up the Middle East in order to institute this Greater Israel idea. And it lays this out in some detail, but let's just take a look at just the operative part of this document, talking about what the Israeli plans for Syria was in this World Zionist Organization document. And it says, quote, "The dissolution of Syria and Iraq later on into ethnically or religiously unique areas, such as in Lebanon, is Israel's primary target on the Eastern Front in the long run, while the dissolution of the military power of those states serves as the primary short-term target. Syria will fall apart, in accordance with its ethnic and religious structure, into several states, such as in present-day Lebanon, so that there will be a Shiite Alawi state along its coast, a Sunni state in the Aleppo area, another Sunni state in Damascus, hostile to its northern neighbor, and the Druzes, who will set up a state, maybe even in our Golan, and certainly in the Hauran and in northern Jordan. This state of affairs will be the guarantee for peace and security in the area in the long run, and that aim is already within our reach today," end quote. Yes, peace and security as defined by the Zionists of the Israel foreign policy planning community, i.e. peace and stability for Israel. And certainly it does absolutely play into Israel's interests to keep the Middle East area divided ethnically and religiously and get those different sects fighting with each other, because that obviously makes for the command for the divide and conquer strategy that has been the go-to strategy for would-be imperialists and tyrants for millennia, and it certainly does serve Israel's foreign policy purposes to keep the Muslims fighting amongst each other along their religious and sectarian lines, rather than fighting against Israel. And that's exactly, lo and behold, what is happening in Syria, as we see the Sunni majority fighting against the Alawite sect, that the minority that has been in power under Assad and under his father for decades now in Syria. And it is interesting to see not only, of course, the native inhabitant Sunnis of Syria, but of course all the foreign-funded jihadists who are being shipped into the country, who are fueling this very conflict. And in fact, if people go back to my interviews on RT back at the very start of this Syrian uprising, back two and a half years ago now, you'll see that I made this point specifically, that part of what this is all about is the destabilization of the Shia land bridge, the so-called land bridge that connects Iran all the way to its Hezbollah forces in Lebanon through that Shia land bridge that runs through Syria. But if that can be destabilized and the Shia Alawite sect minority that rules Syria can be replaced with a Sunni majority ruling over the country, then that would break up that that link between Iran and Lebanon and would further destabilize and isolate Iran on the path towards committing, well, the ultimate strike on Iran. And this is something that can be seen in the policy planning documents of various think tanks, such as the now infamous Which Path to Persia document from the Brookings Institution, which Tony Cartolucci of Land Destroyer Report has written about so much. So there are definite geopolitical interests for Israel and its adjunct to the United States in the Middle East in keeping Syria divided against each other, and that is a very key part in what's taking place there in Syria. But that isn't all. Surprisingly enough for people in the United States, there are other factors in the Middle East other than the United States and Israel. And there are other players who are trying to become regional players in various different degrees as a result of this. And of course, in that regard, we have to look to some of Syria's neighbors and some of the other people in the region who are looking to step up, including Turkey and Qatar and Saudi Arabia, and how they all fit into this and what their part to play is in this Syrian drama. And as we start to expand the scope of this, of course, one of the things that, as always in these Middle Eastern conflicts, comes into play is the resource wars that is always at least part of what's going on. So let's take a look at one of the interesting developments in recent years that has really, I think, been one of the focal points for why it is so important to kick off the Syrian war now, and that is the prospect of an Iran-Iraq-Syria pipeline. Now, this is something that, in fact, has been on the table for a couple of years now, and just for more information on that, let's quickly turn to the Tehran Times from July 26th of 2011, which had this story: Iran, Iraq, Syria sign major gas pipeline deal. Iran, Iraq, and Syria have signed a deal for the construction of the Middle East's largest gas pipeline, which would transit Iranian gas from Iran's South Pars gas field to Europe via Lebanon and the Mediterranean Sea. According to the deal, Iranian gas will be transited to Greece and other European countries via a 6,000-kilometer pipeline crossing through Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, and under the Mediterranean Sea, end quote. Now, this is an exceptionally important pipeline because, as you might have noticed there, this gas is being transported from the Iranian South Pars field, the largest known gas field in the world, to via Iraq, via Syria, through Lebanon, the Mediterranean, to Europe directly, which would mean Iranian gas going to Europe, which would be something that would be quite a boon for the increasingly isolated Iranian government, of course, and one that would potentially upset the balance of power in the increasing moves towards isolating Iran, but also exceptionally significant because it bypasses, for example, Turkey, which has positioned itself as being the east-west energy crossroads where all of these pipelines tend to transit through on their way to Europe. This would bypass Turkey altogether, so that would upset a would-be regional power like Turkey as well. So this is an exceptionally important pipeline. Again, the memorandum of understanding on it has been inked, and this has been moved just one step closer towards becoming a reality, which is another reason why this destabilization had to take place and why it is taking place. Now, this has been commented on by a number of different analysts. So,
there you have it. There's a pipeline. That's the real reason. Just like the oil was in Iraq, and special minerals, one of the largest mineral resources in the world is in Afghanistan, and plus the other players, geopolitical players in the area. So you see, we finally get a more honest perspective of why we're sacrificing people in this needless slaughter. I'm sure many of you heard about this football player that was shot 10 times and killed, even though he was unarmed, and he was simply trying to find someone to help him with his car. This brings me to a short commentary from Chris Hedges, The Origins of Our Police State in Truth Dig. I'll quote this. We have no civil liberties yet left. Police who arrest some 13 million people a year in the United States, 1.6 million on drug charges, half of those for marijuana counts, carry out random searches and sweeps with no probable cause. They take DNA samples from many of those they arrest, even some eventually found to be innocent, to build a nationwide database. They confiscate cash, cars, homes, and other possessions based on allegations of illegal drug activity and direct the proceeds into police budgets. In the last three decades, the United States has constructed the world's largest prison system, populated with 2.2 million inmates. As in most police states, cops serve as judge and jury on city streets. A long step down the totalitarian path, in the words of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Waymo Douglas in 1968, when he decried expanding police powers. And police departments are bolstered by an internal surveillance and security apparatus that has eradicated privacy and dwarfed the intrusion into personal lives by police states in the past, including East Germany. Under a series of Supreme Court rulings, we have lost the rights to protect ourselves from random searches, home invasions, warrantless wiretapping, and eavesdropping and physical abuse. Police units in poor neighborhoods function as armed gangs. The pressure to build departmental arrest quotas, the prerequisite for lavish federal aid in the war on drugs, results in police routinely seizing people at will and charging them with a laundry list of crimes, often without any just cause. Because many of these crimes carry long mandatory sentences, it's easy to intimidate defendants into pleading out on lesser offenses. The police and the defendants know that the collapsed court system, in which the poor get only a few minutes with a public attorney, means there is little chance the abused can challenge the system. And there's also a large pool of willing informants who, to reduce their own sentences, will often tell a court anything demanded of them by the police. In conclusion, the tyranny of law enforcement in poor communities is a window into our emerging police state. These thuggish tactics are now being used against activists and dissidents. And as the nation unravels, as social unrest spreads, the naked face of police repression will become commonplace. Totalitarian systems always seek license to engage in this kind of behavior by first targeting and demonizing the minority. Such systems demand that the police, to combat the so-called lawlessness of the demonized minority, be in essence emancipated from the constraints of the law. The unrestricted and arbitrary subjugation of one despised group stripped of equality before the law conditions the police use to employ their tactics against a wider society. Once you're branded a felon, then you are barred from public housing by law, discriminated against by private landlords, ineligible for food stamps, forced to check the box indicating a felony conviction on employment applications for nearly every job, and denied licenses for a wide range of professions. And this is for people who might have had only a small quantity of drugs, perhaps a few ounces of marijuana. There are 6 million people who, because of felony convictions, are permanently shut out of from mainstream society. They are second-class citizens, outcasts. They were on drugs, aided by hundreds of millions of federal dollars, along with federal donations of high-velocity weapons, helicopters, command vehicles, and SWAT team military training has become the template for future social control. Poor people of color know the truth. They were the first victims. The rest of us are about to find it out. End quote, Chris Hedges. And just as one final thought here, covert human papillomavirus vaccine trials, government report, Gates, Merck, GlaxoSmithKline, targeting illiterate adolescents without consent in India, Uganda, and Peru. In a report in the Indian Parliament, healthcare experts, led by committee chair Sherry Singh, reported last week that thousands of mostly illiterate families and adolescent children in the impoverished Khammam district of Pradesh were targeted without consent by the Program for Appropriate Technology Health in vaccine trials for the human papillomavirus. And so it goes. I'm Gary Knoll, and that brings us up to the end of our regular programming, and we thank you for listening. Now it's time for TalkBack, 888-874-4888. Your turn to call in and share your thoughts. Joining me in studio right now in New York City is Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Well, boy, your audience is reeling about the an article that I saw that Congress actually created an option for themselves to exclude themselves from Obamacare. Now, isn't that just, I mean, that speaks volumes. So you've got a lot of people in your audience emailing me. What's up with this? They want to know, what are your thoughts on it and what can we do about it?
I'm opposed to everything about Obamacare because it's a complete fraud. First, there's nothing in our health care bill that promotes health, prevents disease, or allows people to be properly educated about why we are so sick, that we're the sickest nation on the planet per population. It, not a word in there, tells us how we reduce the epidemic of childhood diabetes, childhood arthritis, childhood epilepsy, childhood autism, and childhood immunological dysfunction. It does not help us understand why the number one cause of death in 10 to 14-year-old boys is suicide. It doesn't help us at all stop the toxic drugs that are killing people with their side effects. It does not stop defensive medicine. We should have no-fault medicine, meaning you cannot, under any conditions, sue a doctor, hospital, or nurse. Instead, there is a pool of money that is given by the pharmaceutical industry, the hospitals, and the doctors, and that covers appropriate treatment for anyone who has been hurt or damaged. That, in turn, would prevent the doctors and the hospitals from doing excessive testing, which we do not need. Many of those tests are dangerous. And the additional drugging that goes with those, that would save $200 billion a year. It would also probably protect about 100,000 people from dying that otherwise wouldn't. It also, there's nothing in Obamacare that educates senior citizens of what they actually need. The average senior citizen in the United States, over 70, is consuming 16 different medications. Now, when you see that the doctor's not aware of the combinations of these medications, then it shows that we are literally abusing our senior citizens. We're abusing our young people, and we're not getting a nation healthier. So our health care system is flawed, and nothing in Obamacare will help that. And also, I realize the Democrats and the corporate liberals have a hard time understanding this, but there are bureaucracies that do not serve any good. And yet they support almost all bureaucracies, no matter how metastasized they become and worthless and technocratic and bureaucratic they are. And once you start a bureaucracy, be aware, it will only grow. And then one day, no one pays attention to what its initial cause was for. It's just that it's there to be supported by us, those of us who actually have a functioning, meaningful life. They don't. And unfortunately, there is no system now in place, no checks and balances for proper oversight of any bureaucracy. So let's just say that we need health care. We do. Should our health care be written by the insurance companies that are for profit, the hospitals for profit, and the pharmaceuticals for profit? Because those are the only people who had any input on Obamacare. 117 meetings, not one was by anyone who actually understands health prevention, disease, and reversal. Not one. Yet we required that someone pay attention. They chose not to. So why would you trust people whose only motive in a bill, writing it and promoting it, is they profit from it? Now, then you'll have those individuals who look at the military-industrial complex and not a word about reducing from Democrats or Republicans that budget of $1.3 trillion, and yet we're putting people off of social programs they need. We have 18 million hungry children that we are not feeding. We have 1.5 million children going to school who have no home. They're homeless. So why is it that our empathy, our concern is always for those in power and never those without power? So Obamacare is a corrupt, completely vile piece of legislation, and anyone with a brain and a heart and a conscience would know that where we need health care, and we need one affordable health care, which means universal health care, that is the only humanistic and appropriate way to approach it. And yet we will not do that because it is not in the economic and political interests of those who are the policymakers and the corporate whores that they own, which are all in their pocket, including Democrats in The Nation magazine and all the other pseudo-intellects. I've yet to meet a true intellect from that group. Hope that answers the question.
Can you be a little more candid?
I can, but I'd have to be I'd have to be vulgar, and I don't want to be.
All right.
But I'm so opposed to that. Now, quickly, you, I was told this morning, were filled up for the first week of our upcoming retreat for BAI, but you're now looking for people who'd like to be work-study for the second week.
Yes, it's very exciting. Wonderful, nice people calling and wanting to be part of this. So if anyone's interested in becoming part of a life-transforming week with Gary and myself, give me a call. I'm at 631-504-6198, 631-504-6198. Be around like-minded people who are positive, upbeat, and ready to have some fun and make some positive changes.
Juicing, gourmet foods, cooking classes, farming classes, survival classes in sustainable agriculture, meditation, exercising, water aerobics, a wonderful environment, great teachers coming in from around the United States, and because it's work study, it's half price, $1,000, and this is a fundraiser for WBAI. So we're supporting it because we believe in the station and its future, and you can support the station and support your good health. A wonderful week. It's the second week of October. So call Luann. Luann?
631-504-6198.
Thank you all. And now let's say hello to Utrecht Lead. Hi, Utrecht. Hi, Utrecht. Are you there?
Yes, Gary. There's a kind of a lag, and sometimes bits and pieces go missing. So I was told that it has to do with the internet on my end here. But sometimes when it rains, it happens that way. But today, of course, is Open Forum Day, where listeners take the conversation wherever they want it to go.
Great. Utrecht Lead, I just looked at her numbers. She has more people listening today on the Progressive Radio Network and downloading her programs each week than she ever had in 20 years on the air at WBAI. How about that? That's an audience finding it. And by the way, Utrecht, a lot of people are saying, when you come to New York and come to visit and do a lecture at some of the community centers.
In fact, you know what? I need to do exactly that. I need to organize something because I've been getting the same thing as well. So
I'll
work on it.
Then our mantra today is let's get Utrecht to New York. All right?
Thanks, sir. Thanks, Gary.
All right. Utrecht Lead right now.